paralleled by frequent spells that call on the snake to lie down, fall down, get down, or crawl away. Pyramid Text 226, 233, 234, 298, and 386. Another says that he should go with his face on the path. Pyramid Text 288. These suggest that when God tells the serpent that he will crawl on his belly, there is no suggestion that the serpent had legs that he now loses. Instead, he is going to be docile rather than in an attack position. The serpent on its belly is non-threatening, while the one reared up is protecting or attacking. Notice that on the Pharaoh's crown, the serpent, Uraeus, is pictured as upright and in an attack position. Nevertheless, I should also note that there are occasional depictions of serpent creatures with legs. There is no indication, however, of an occasion in which serpents lost their legs. Eat Dust, Chapter 3, Verse 14. Eating dust is not a comment about the actual diet of a snake. It is more likely a reference to their habitat. Again, the pyramid texts show some similarity as they attempt to banish the serpent to the dust. The serpent is a creature of the netherworld. That is why the Pharaoh encounters it on his journey, and denizens of the netherworld were typically portrayed as eating dust. So, in The Descent of Ishtar, the netherworld is described as a place where their food is dust and their bread is clay. Crush Your Head, Chapter 3, Verse 15. Treading on the serpent is used in Pyramid Texts 299 as an expression of overcoming or defeating it. Specific statements indicate that the sandal of Horus tramples the snake underfoot. Pyramid Texts 378. And Horus has shattered the snake's mouth with the sole of his foot. Pyramid Texts 388. This reflects a potentially mortal blow to this deadly enemy. There is no suggestion that the Israelites are borrowing from the pyramid texts, only that these texts help us to determine how someone in the ancient Near East might understand such words and phrases. Strike His Heel, Chapter 3, Verse 15. It is true that the ancients were aware that many snakes were not poisonous. But since harmless snakes usually were not seen as aggressive, if someone were bitten by a snake, it was assumed that the snake might be poisonous. Thus, the strike to the heel is a potentially mortal blow. As an example of several of these items, the Pyramid Texts, Utterance 378. O snake in the sky! O centipede on earth! The sandal of Horus is what tramples the knee snake underfoot. It is dangerous for me, so I have trodden on you. Be wise about me, and I will not tread on you, for you are the mysterious and invisible one of whom the gods speak. Because you are the one who has no legs, because you are the one who has no arms with which you could walk after your brethren the gods, beware of me, and I will beware of you. In the examples, we can understand how information about the serpent in the Genesis account can be documented in various ways in the ancient Near East. A separate direction of inquiry could comb the ancient Near East for serpent symbolism, interpret it, and then try to bring those elements into an understanding of the Bible without biblical precedent. Unfortunately, such attempts are bound to produce unsatisfactory results, since there are just too many different aspects to serpent symbolism. We would have no way to conclude confidently which ones the Israelites would prefer or which would be significant in any given context. Serpent symbolism has been connected to fertility, sexuality, protection, life, death, and numerous other important attributes. While many of these motifs may well have been familiar to the mind of an Israelite, especially one who had been recently in Egypt, we want to explore the question of the nature of the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. If the Israelites would not have thought of the serpent as Satan, and there is no evidence that they did, in fact, they have a far less developed idea of Satan than what we find in the New Testament, then what would they have thought? We can begin with the description that is given in Genesis chapter 3. The main adjective used there identifies the serpent as Arum, variously translated as subtle, wily, cunning, shrewd, prudent, or clever. It is an adjective that operates primarily in reference to wisdom and is inherently neutral. That is, it is a quality that can be used well. Proverbs chapter 1 verse 4 and chapter 8 verse 5, or in questionable ways. Exodus chapter 21 verse 14 and Joshua chapter 9 verse 4. Tzioni Tzivit offers a helpful profile of someone who is Arum. They conceal what they feel and what they know. Proverbs chapter 12 verses 16 and 23. They esteem knowledge and plan how to use it in achieving their objectives. Proverbs chapter 13 verse 16 and chapter 14 verses 8 and 18. They do not believe everything they hear. Proverbs chapter 14 verse 15. And they know how to avoid trouble and punishment. Proverbs chapter 22 verse 3 and chapter 27 verse 12. In sum, they are shrewd and calculating, willing to bend and torture the limits of acceptable behavior, but not to cross the line into illegalities. They may be unpleasant and purposely misleading in speech, but are not out-and-out liars. Joshua chapter 9 verse 4 and 1 Samuel chapter 23 verse 22. They know how to read people and situations, and how to turn their readings to advantage. A keen wit and a rapier tongue are their tools. Ultimately, such a descriptor does not aid us in determining the creature's nature. Other than that, we can only identify the serpent as one of the wild animals the Lord God had made. Genesis chapter 3 verse 1. At the same time, we should notice that the serpent is not described as evil. This devious creature does not become associated with evil until much later. Recent study has focused attention on the serpent as a chaos creature. Chaos creatures in the ancient world were typically composite creatures that belonged to the sphere of the divine, yet were not deified. Their composite features gave them a combination of attributes. In the ancient world, the chaos creatures are not thought of as evil. They are amoral, but can be mischievous or destructive. They cause problems if left unchecked, but can be domesticated and become associates of gods. Demons also function much like chaos creatures, as do liminal creatures. For example, coyote, screech owl. It is true that the Hebrew word for the serpent, nachash, is one of the normal ways to designate a common snake. Furthermore, the snake in Genesis chapter 3 is identified as among the creatures of the field that God created, and nothing in the text suggests it is a composite creature. Nevertheless, all creatures in the Hebrew Bible, including chaos creatures, are created by God. Genesis chapter 1 verse 21. Job chapter 40, verses 15 to 19, Psalm 104, chapter 26. That nachash can also designate a chaos creature is evident from its usage in Isaiah chapter 27, verse 1, where it describes Leviathan. Such an understanding is confirmed finally in the Apocalypse of John, in which the serpent, now Satan, is described as a great dragon. Revelations, chapter 12, verse 9, the chaos creature par excellence. We could therefore conclude that the serpent in Genesis chapter 3 is a chaos creature, on the basis of its role in the story and other supporting contexts. Richard Averbeck is then correct to observe that this is not just a snake story. The Israelites would have seen a great deal more in Genesis chapter 3 than a simple tale about snakes and mankind. From their point of view, this would have been the very beginning of a cosmic battle that they were feeling the effects of in their own personal experience and their national history. Though I am not ready to go as far as he does to conclude that this also represents the fall of Satan, I believe that entering the text from the ancient Israelite viewpoint should lead us to think of the serpent in terms of a chaos creature. What is the result of such an approach? An Israelite would not identify the serpent as Satan. The consequences are far more significant in the account than the agent. The serpent is the catalyst more than the cause. An Israelite would recognize the deleterious effects of the temptation, but would not necessarily consider the serpent to be morally evil or bent on the destruction of humankind. An Israelite would not give any unique status to this serpent. He is just one of any number of chaos creatures, rather than a spiritual, cosmic power of some sort. The Israelites would have thought of the serpent as a sort of disruptive free agent, with less of a thought-out agenda. The Old Testament does not give the serpent an ongoing role. Like the serpent in the Gilgamesh epic, who did what its nature led it to do and then disappeared from the scene, no continuing role or place is recognized for the serpent in the Old Testament, though the consequences of the human act remain in place. Again, as in Gilgamesh. The serpent's insertion of doubt and his nuanced denial of the woman's understanding of the consequences stated by God would not be interpreted any differently than in our traditional understanding. Deception, misdirection, and troublemaking are all within the purview of chaos creatures. It is important to note the syntactical subtlety that is evident in the serpent's words. He does not say, "You will not die." Instead, the placement of the negation results in something more like, "Don't think that death is such an immediate threat." God told the truth. When they ate from the tree, they were doomed to die. The words God used did not suggest immediate death. The syntactical expression that he uses, "on the day that," is simply the Hebrew idiom for "when." But the penalty was carried out by removing their access to the tree of life. They were therefore immediately doomed to die, the force of the verbal construction. The woman was not as careful in her wording, and the serpent therefore told the truth when he picked up on the discrepancy and contradicted her, not God, by saying that death was not an immediate threat. In this way, the serpent's deception came in exploiting a misrepresentation by the woman and telling her of a benefit to eating the fruit without likewise including the deleterious effects. Notice that the serpent does not suggest outright that Eve eat the fruit or that she should disobey. At the same time, there is no room for the suggestion that it was the serpent who told the truth, "You will not die, you shall be like gods," and God who was wrong, "In the day that you eat from it, you will surely die." God's statement did not indicate immediate death. "In the day" is the Hebrew way of saying "when." The construction often translated, "surely die," expresses only that they will at that time be doomed to die, which is exactly what happened when the way of the tree of life was barred. The Israelite would understand that the result of the serpent's role was that evil took root among humanity. This is clear from Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, where an ongoing battle is portrayed between humans, generation to generation, on one side, and the seed, or offspring of the serpent, which does not refer to future generations of serpents, but to the evil that had resulted, on the other side. The fact that the two verbs in the verse that describe the antagonistic actions are from the same root, despite the fact that many translations render them differently, shows that the verse does not indicate who the victor will be. Instead, it indicates that there will be an ongoing exchange of potentially mortal blows. We might well ask what a chaos creature was doing in the garden, the center of order in the cosmos. Surprisingly, when we examine the text closely, we discover that the text never suggests that the serpent was in the garden, let alone in the tree. If we inquire how then Adam and Eve would have encountered the creature, we must note that Adam and Eve's tasks in the garden do not necessitate their constant presence. Priests, serving in sacred space, do not live in sacred space. While the placing of Adam in the garden may suggest a more permanent residence, we would have to ask whether that meant he would never leave. Much is unspecified in the text. As a chaos creature, the serpent would be more closely associated with non-order than with disorder. Non-order has a certain neutrality to it, whereas disorder is evil in nature and intent. We might describe an earthquake or a cancer as forces of non-order with evil consequences, but they are not inherently evil. We do not control them, and therefore they can have disastrous effects. If the serpent truly is in the category of chaos creature, neither his contradiction of God's statement nor his deception about the consequences are part of an evil agenda. They are simply the disruptive, ad hoc behavior that chaos creatures engage in. More complete understanding is offered in intertestamental literature and New Testament theology. But if we limit our analysis to the ancient context of the Old Testament, things look very different. Excursus. Myth/mythology. I remain uncomfortable applying the genre label myth/mythology to these biblical narratives. The designation has too many definitions, and therefore the words lose their ability to communicate clearly. Furthermore, we have so thoroughly adapted these terms to Western culture that their application to ancient culture becomes inevitably anachronistic. But the issue goes beyond the labeling of a genre of literature. It concerns the process by which literature of any genre is conceived and composed. The ancients think differently. They perceive the world in different ways, with different categories and priorities than we do. In our culture, we think scientifically. We are primarily concerned with causation, composition, and systematization. In the ancient world, they are more likely to think of the world in terms of symbols and to express their understanding by means of imagery. We are primarily interested in events and material realia, whereas they are more interested in ideas and their representation. Some might suggest that the Israelites who crafted the early chapters of Genesis are historicizing myth, that is, presenting real events using imagery as a rhetorical means to capture the full range of truth as it is commonly conveyed in the world in which they live. Since the concept of myth, mythic or mythical or mythological, however, is so volatile and diversely understood, we need to use it in connection with other qualifying terms. The word group, image, or imagery, or imagination, or imaginative, would work well, though imagery would be incorrect. A rhetoric using mythical imagery is easily discernible in biblical poetry. For example, from the heavens the stars fought, or crushed the heads of Leviathan, Psalm 74, verse 14. And it becomes formalized in the genre of apocalyptic. Nevertheless, It is not absent from prose. To describe this sort of thinking, I would like to adapt the term imagistic. It offers a distinction that is easy to understand in today's culture, as we find that students are increasingly visual learners, a fact that compels us to be more imagistic in our teaching and communication. Rather than attempting to define it in accordance with true imagistic thinking, I will instead describe by illustrations. Imagistic thinking and representation would stand in contrast to scientific or analytical thinking. We can see the difference if we compare two visual representations of the night sky, one taken by the Hubble telescope, the other presented by Vincent van Gogh's The Starry Night. People would never consider doing astronomy from the van Gogh, and could not do so even if they wanted to. The image contains nothing of the composition or position of stars. At the same time, we would not say that it is a false depiction of the night sky. Visual artists depict the world imagistically, and we recognize that this depiction is independent of science, but not independent of truth. The ancients apply this same imagistic conception to all genres of literature, including those that we cannot conceive of as anything other than scientific. Imagistic history, like that preserved in Genesis, is to history as the starry night is to a Hubble photograph. As another example, we would not try to reconstruct historically the bombardment of Fort McHenry in the War of 1812 by a detailed analysis of the Star-Spangled Banner. Note how our national anthem is set in a historical context, but uses the rhetoric of imagery and the power of symbol, the flag, in an artistic way to convey an enduring truth and value that reaches far beyond the War of 1812. A modern-day example of terminology that offers an alternative to scientific/historical thinking would be what Lutherans today refer to as sacramental thinking, a highly controversial term that includes the mystical aspects of the sacraments, but goes beyond it into the wider realm of religious thought. In such a context, they find it quite a natural way of thinking. In those traditions, people realize that such thinking is not subject to scientific verification, and historicity is simply not a category that would have any meaning. People who are used to sacramental thinking, however defined, find it very hard to describe it, or defend it, to those who are not so inclined. The fact that this seems like a new and unfamiliar way of thinking to some who are not Lutheran, or connected with other traditions at home with sacramental thinking, demonstrates the point I am making. Imagistic thinking presents similar difficulties. Israelites found no problems thinking about Ezekiel's vision of Egypt as a cosmic tree. Ezekiel chapter 31. This does not warrant labeling the literature mythology, nor does it concern questions of reality or truth. Some might consider the trees, the garden, and the snake to be examples of imagistic thinking without thereby denying reality and truth to the account. The author understands trees in a way that does not simply indicate a botanical species of flora with remarkable chemical properties. When we put these elements in their ancient Near Eastern context and recognize the Israelite capacity and even propensity to think in imagistic terms, we may find that we gain a deeper understanding of important theological realities. Some scholars today believe that Israel was in the habit of borrowing other people's myths and transforming them into a mythology of their own. I do not share that perspective. What is sometimes perceived as a shared mythology is more often a shared propensity to think imagistically about the same issues using a shared symbolic vocabulary. Nicholas Wyatt distinguishes between those who use the oral discourse of story to represent reality, and those who analyze the observed world and formulate hypothetical paradigms to explain that which is observed. Imagistic thinking is not only to be contrasted with causation analysis. It also stands in contrast to metaphysics, which, though not a science, is a product of scientific thinking in that it is also interested in intermediate causation and systematization. These are varying ways to communicate ideas about identity and coherence. This discussion quickly becomes very esoteric and is both out of my area of expertise and out of the range of this book. I have raised this issue not to solve the questions it entails, but to elevate our consciousness of yet another way in which we think quite differently from how people in the ancient world thought. This generates the repeated warning that we have to take care not to impose our categories of thinking on the literature that was more at home in the ancient world than in ours. Proposition 15. Adam and Eve chose to make themselves the center of order and source of wisdom, thereby admitting disorder into the cosmos. This is not the place to offer a full analysis of the nature of sin, law, accountability, guilt, and punishment. These are matters of theology and would require a trained theologian to provide a credible treatment. The issues are complex, and the debate about the particulars can be traced throughout the entire history of the Church. The focus of this book is neither on the systematic theology of the Church, nor on trying to sort out the distinctions between, for example, Augustine and Pelagius or Irenaeus. Instead, we are exploring how Genesis chapter 3 might have been understood against the backdrop of the ancient world, and what claims are being made in this context. It is certainly important to eventually factor in what Paul has to say on the matter, and to form our theology in deep interaction with the Church Fathers. But our starting point needs to be the text of Genesis itself, in its cultural, literary, and theological context. As Mark Biddle points out, one of the most common ways that people think about sin today is as a crime, a view that Biddle considers to be inadequate, biblically and theologically. In another book, Sin, A History, Gary Anderson investigates the competing paradigms of sin as a burden to be borne and sin as a debt to be repaid. The former metaphor, he contends, is the view supported by the idioms found in the Old Testament, bearing sin, slash guilt, slash punishment, as early as Cain's statement in Genesis chapter 4, verse 13. The latter imagery of debt becomes more prominent in the Second Temple period. These paradigms speak eloquently to the consequences of sin, burden, debt, and point the way to its resolution. A second way that one could analyze sin is by the various Hebrew words that are used to express it. Here, some caution is advisable. For example, it is not uncommon to encounter the statement that sin in the Old Testament means missing the mark. This kind of statement, unfortunately, exposes a misunderstanding of how semantics work. It is true that the verb chet can refer to failing to achieve an objective, Proverbs chapter 8, verse 36, Isaiah chapter 65, verse 20, and is even used once for slingers who do not miss their target, Judges chapter 20, verse 16. There is no reason, however, to think of these uses as reflecting the original meaning of the word that is translated sin. The meanings of words are derived from their use, not from their etymology, and this verb simply means to sin. It is not necessarily limited to the idea of missing a mark or failing to achieve an objective. The words for sin can help us to recognize its various guises: rebellion, transgression, iniquity, guilt. But such semantic analysis can only take us so far. In a third approach, others might talk about what sin does rather than what sin is. In this sort of investigation, sin can be seen as a threat to relationship with God. It results in alienation. This differs from the direction represented in the discussion of the paradigms, in that they addressed the consequences primarily with regard to us, burden, debt, whereas alienation addresses more particularly the consequences pertaining to our relationship with God. The concept of alienation is well recognized in the Old Testament, whether in the banishment of Adam and Eve from the garden or the exile of Israel from the land. It is built into the ideas surrounding sacred space in which holiness must be maintained for the presence of God, lest he be driven away. Sin is therefore disruptive to the relationship with God that is the deepest desire of humans. Relationship was God's intention in creation of human beings. It was lost in Genesis chapter 3, and the rest of Scripture documents the stages of its being reestablished. Another way to express this is in terms of the disequilibrium caused by sin. The biblical model sees sin as the disequilibrium pervasive in a system of disarray. Authentic human existence aspires to realize its full potential of godlikeness, while consistently acknowledging its creatureliness and limitations. Sin is disequilibrium in this aspiration, humanity failing to reflect its divine calling, humanity forgetting its limitations. These approaches are not mutually exclusive, and though the first two have their validity and make a contribution to our understanding, it is the alienation/disequilibrium model that will serve as the focus for the discussion of this chapter. This is a significant theological trajectory that is often neglected or not even recognized. If Genesis chapter 1 is about order and sacred space, the disorder aspect of sin takes on new importance. Disequilibrium, disorder, has disturbed equilibrium, order, that God had set in place. Systematic theology eventually develops other trajectories and gives them high priority. But in the Old Testament, this view takes account of how sin is introduced in these early chapters of Genesis, where order and its antitheses are so important. The Old Testament never refers to the event of Genesis chapter 3 as the fall, and does not talk about people or the world as fallen. This is logical enough terminology, since biblical language does refer to falling into temptation, etc., but we should be cautious about giving the concept too large a role in our discussion of the biblical text. The Old Testament does not speak of Adam's sin bringing sin on everyone, though the effects of sin are seen to be pervasive throughout the Old Testament. One of the earliest uses of the fall is found in the pseudepigraphical book of 2 Esdras, chapter 7, verse 118. O Adam, what have you done? For though it was you who sinned, the fall was not yours alone, but ours also, who are your descendants. With that disclaimer, I will continue to use the term throughout the chapter for convenience, and because it has traditionally been used to encapsulate the problem of sin. As we consider the Old Testament information, we should be clear that the fall is not just disobedience or eating forbidden fruit. These actions could be considered crimes, but they were crimes that were simply the expressions of the fall. The fall was the decision to be like God, conveyed by the serpent's words. Genesis chapter 3, verse 5. The woman's response. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. God's assessment. Genesis chapter 3, verse 22. And the reason for the banishment. Genesis chapter 3, verse 23. The way in which the man and woman have become like God is qualified in relation to what the tree represented. No suggestion is made that they have become omniscient or omnipotent. I propose that, by disobediently taking the fruit, they were trying to be like God by positing themselves as the center and source of order. God is, by definition, the source of wisdom, and His presence therefore establishes a center of wisdom. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom, in its biblical focus, concerns seeking order in all categories of life: speech, family, government, interpersonal relations, relationship with God, decision-making, etc. Wisdom is the result when we perceive order, pursue it, preserve it, promote it, procure it, and practice it. True wisdom finds its source and center in God, not in oneself specifically or humankind in general. In taking from the tree, Adam and Eve were trying to set themselves up as a satellite center of wisdom apart from God. It is a childish sort of response. I can do it myself, or I want to do it my way. These are not a rejection of authority per se, but an insistence on independence. The act is an assertion that it's all about me, and it is one that has characterized humanity, individually and corporately, since this first act. With people as the source and center of wisdom, the result was not order centered on them, but disorder. The disorder extended to all people of all time as well as to the cosmos, and life in God's presence was forfeited. We will discuss this in more depth in the next chapter. Wisdom is good, and we can therefore safely assume that God did not intend to withhold it from humanity. But true wisdom must be acquired through a process, generally from instruction by those who are wise. The fall is defined by the fact that Adam and Eve acquired wisdom illegitimately. Genesis chapter 3, verse 22. Thus trying to take God's role for themselves, rather than eventually joining God in His role as they were taught wisdom and became the fully functional vice-regents of God involved in the process of bringing order. If humans are to work alongside of God in extending order, subdue and rule, Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, they need to attain wisdom, but as endowment from God, not by seizing it for autonomous use. Given this interpretation, I would disagree with those who see the fall as disobedience to an arbitrarily chosen test case. I refer to the view that the trees had no inherent properties, but just served to provide an opportunity for obedience, knowledge of good, or disobedience, knowledge of evil. In this view, God could just as easily have said that they shouldn't walk on the beach. Instead, I maintain that what was taken, wisdom, is not arbitrary, and that it is more important than it was taken, failed a test. If, as proposed earlier, Proposition 8, a legitimate option is that from the start people were mortal, and pain and suffering were already a part of a not yet fully ordered cosmos, we cannot think of death and suffering as having been foisted on us by Adam and Eve's malfeasance. Many have thought it unfair that all of us should suffer the consequences of their offense. Instead, we can have a much more charitable attitude toward Adam and Eve when we realize that it is not that they initiated a situation that was not already there. It is that they failed to achieve a solution to that situation that was in their reach. Their choices resulted in their failure to acquire relief on our behalf. Their failure meant that we are doomed to death and a disordered world full of sin. These are profoundly significant consequences for what was a serious offense. In contrast, Christ was able to achieve the desired result, where Adam and Eve failed. We are all doomed to die because when they sinned, we lost access to the tree of life. We are therefore subject to death because of sin. Christ succeeded and actually provided the remedy to sin and death. Some would follow this same line of reasoning to suggest that what we call original sin is the result of our ancestors pulling out of the program prematurely. James Gaffney identifies these approaches as involving a view that our human condition is underdeveloped, failing to achieve the intended goal because we wanted to do it our way. Not paradise lost, but, as it were, paradise ungained. I would go a step further. We did not lose paradise as much as we forfeited sacred space and the relationship it offered, thereby damaging our ability to be in relationship with God and marring His creation with our own underdeveloped ability to bring order on our own, in our own wisdom. Yoda laments similarly about Luke Skywalker in the Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back, that he is not yet ready because his training is not complete. Reckless is he. Now things are worse. Thus far, the treatment in this chapter has been trying to recover an Old Testament perspective on these issues. In that way, the lost world we seek to recover is being revealed from analysis inside the biblical text. We can now turn our attention briefly to the ancient world outside the biblical text. There is nothing like the fall in ancient Near Eastern literature, because there is no idealized primeval scenario. In Mesopotamian thinking, civilization in the urban environment was the ideal, and the world outside was populated by wild animals, primeval monsters, demons, drifting souls, and nomads. That world outside picture was also the description of primeval times. There is no original pair, no sacred space, no disobedience of a command, no grasping for wisdom to become like God. Even discussion of sin is problematic in an ancient Near Eastern context. They certainly understood the concept of offending a deity and suffering for it, but the gods had not made their expectations known. As described in Chapter 9, the great symbiosis in the ancient world is that the responsibility of humans is to meet the needs of the gods. This mostly involved ritual performance, but it also included ethical behavior insofar as it was recognized that the gods desired sufficient justice in order to ensure a smoothly operating society. A lawless society would be a less productive society, and people would not be able to grow their crops, raise their herds, and make their gifts to the gods. In both the ancient Near East and the Old Testament, sin was often objectified, that is, it was seen as something almost physical to be carried and could be lifted off a person. It was realized in physical consequences, illness especially. But as mentioned earlier, these deal with the consequences of sin. Both contexts may have dealt with sin as objectified, but when we ask what constituted sin, strong differences emerge. Though ethical behavior was essential in the ancient Near East, a moral imperative based on a discernment of God's nature, as is found in Israel, was lacking. The gods had not revealed themselves, and they were not known to be consistent in character. Consequently, we find many of the same ethical expectations in the ancient world at large as we find in Israel. But the source of such norms in Israelite thinking, God instead of society, the reasoning behind them, holiness for retaining the presence of God, and their objectives, being God-like, are all very different. The ethical norms of the ancient Near East are most concerned with order versus disorder in society, whereas in Israel the main focus is on relationship with deity and what is right or wrong as one seeks to live in accordance with the holiness of God. We likewise find similar ritual performances, but, again, they are driven by a very different ideology. For these reasons, we expect nothing like the fall in ancient Near Eastern thinking. The people of the ancient Near East had to have seen themselves in relationship with God for that relationship to be broken. Neither the gods nor the people desired relationship outside the confines of the great symbiosis. What we find in the Old Testament is a reflection of the revelation of God that resulted in a theology uniquely Israelite. The lost world then needs to be recovered, not by learning more about the ancient Near East, but by getting back to the Old Testament texts in their ancient context before taking into account the way the interpretation of these texts unfolded in the New Testament and the articulation of theological understanding throughout church history. That does not mean rejection of the later developments, but for the purposes of understanding the Old Testament text in its context, it is important to see the issues that frame the text in their ancient setting. In conclusion, Genesis chapter 3 is more about the encroachment of disorder, brought about by sin, into a world in the process of being ordered than it is about the first sin. It is about how humanity lost access to the presence of God when its representatives tragically declared their independence from their Creator. It is more focused, literally than theologically, on how corporate humanity is therefore distanced from God, alienation, than on the sinful state of each human being, with no intention of diminishing the latter fact. A similar reflection of the differences of perspective can also be seen in how we think about theological anthropology. We are used to talking about the body, soul, and spirit, as we discuss who we are as individuals and what parts will continue to define us in eternity. Egyptians talked about the human person in teleological terms, also showing an interest in the afterlife, terms such as Ba and Ka. In contrast, Babylonians were more inclined to think of humanity in terms of protology, that is, human beings as defining us. In Israel, the terms they used, nefesh, ruach, often translated respectively as soul and spirit, are terms that help define our relationship to God. Nefesh is given by God, Genesis chapter 2 verse 7, and departs when a human being dies, Genesis chapter 35 verse 18. Interestingly enough, God is also characterized by a nefesh. Nefesh is not something that people have. It is something that they are. It is life, and it is associated with the blood. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11. In contrast, ruach energizes and is related to consciousness and vitality. Each person has God's ruach, and it returns to him when the person dies. God's ruach sustains human life. In this way, we might understand their viewpoint as relational and theological rather than psychological components. Neither nefesh nor ruach is considered to exist in the afterlife. What difference does all this make? It does not disagree with the traditional ideas that sin entered the world at a point in time because of choices made by real people in a real past, and that those choices have affected us all. Viewing Adam and Eve as priestly representatives in sacred space who brought the alienation of humanity from God's presence may lead us to frame differently our questions about our current status in the present. This will be explored in the next chapter. At the same time, it changes nothing about the need we have for salvation and the importance of the work of Christ on our behalf. Perhaps, however, it will help us to remind ourselves that salvation is more importantly about what we are saved to, renewed access to the presence of God and relationship with Him, than what we are saved from. This point is significant because too many Christians find it too easy to think only that they are saved, forgiven, and on their way to heaven, instead of taking seriously the idea that we are to be in deepening relationship with God day by day, here and now. Proposition 16. We currently live in a world with non-order, order, and disorder. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, the state of the cosmos at the beginning of the story is that nothing is yet functioning as it should. This non-ordered state serves as the canvas for the creative acts that bring a semblance of order to the cosmos. It contains traditional descriptors of non-order that were typical in ancient Near Eastern thinking: sea and darkness. It also features the spirit, or wind, of God, prepared to go into action. In some of the Egyptian cosmologies, the wind, a manifestation of the god Amun, also plays a role at the beginning of the initiation of creation. Into this non-ordered state, God begins to establish order by decree. In the ancient Near East, one Egyptian text, the Memphite theology, or the Shabako stone, features creation by the spoken word. More importantly, however, throughout Sumerian and Babylonian sources, the gods bring order, both initially as well as year by year, by orally decreeing the destinies of members of the cosmos. To decree the destiny of something is to assign it a role and a function. This is an act of creation as order is established. Consequently, the efficacy of the spoken word in creation is commonplace in the ancient world. God's creative work is defined as bringing order to this non-ordered existence. This will be carried out in stages through a process. Even as God brought order, there were aspects of non-order that remained. There was still a sea, though its borders had been set. There was still darkness. There was an outside the garden that was less ordered than inside the garden. The order that God brought focused on people in His image to join with Him in the continuing process of bringing order, but more importantly, on ordering the cosmos as sacred space. Yet, this was just the beginning. This initial ordering would not have eliminated natural disasters, pain, or death. We do not have to think of these as part of the ordered world, though they are not beyond God's control, and often they can be identified with positive results. All non-order will not be resolved until new creation. In Revelation chapter 21, we are told that there will be no longer any sea. Revelation chapter 21 verse 1. No pain or death. Revelation chapter 21 verse 4. And no darkness. Revelation 21 verses 23 to 25. There is no temple because God's presence will pervade all of it. Revelation chapter 21 verses 3 and 22. Not just concentric circles radiating through zones of diminishing sacredness. God will be with humanity and be their God. Revelation chapter 21 verse 3. Relationship is conveyed through the imagery of husband and wife. Revelation chapter 21 verse 2. This is not a restoration of Eden or the return to a pre-fall condition. New creation is characterized by a level of order that has never before existed. In this sort of thinking, pain and death do not have to be considered part of what is good or ordered. These are aspects that have not yet been finally resolved into a fully ordered world. The world before the fall was a combination of order and non-order, with a strategy launched to continue bringing order. That progress toward order, however, was set back by the entrance of disorder. The serpent, as a chaos creature, was part of the non-ordered world. Its interference, however, launched disorder when people decided they themselves desired to be the source and center of wisdom and order. This sort of understanding now offers explanation of the statement made in the last chapter. With people as the source and center of wisdom, the result was not order centered on them, but disorder in which sin reigned. They were incapable of establishing order on their own with themselves as the center. The disorder this introduced extended to all people of all time, as well as to the cosmos, and life in God's presence was forfeited. Therefore, first of all, we now live in a world characterized, in part, by non-order, because it remains in process of being ordered, a process that is hampered because humans have not filled the role for which they were created. This non-order is reflected in natural disasters, disease and pain, among many other things. Sin is not the cause of all of these aspects of our current situation, but they demonstrate human inability to enforce order within creation. I would additionally be inclined to place at least some demon activity in this category, insofar as they may be amoral and non-volitional spiritual forces that are part of the non-ordered world and bring non-order. This matches the profile that they have in the Gospels. Second, we also live in a world characterized by order, because that is what creation established. We enjoy not only the benefits of the order that God brought and continues to bring, but the benefits of kingdom order established through the work of Christ. Furthermore, humans have brought the benefits of order throughout history through discovery and invention, technology and industry. These very same human advances that bring order, however, often also bring disorder, because we too often proceed with our own selfish ends, guiding us, ourselves as the center of order, rather than recognizing that we are stewards of sacred space. Consequently, and third, we also live in a world characterized by disorder. This disorder is found in the ways that we harm the environment, the ways that we harm one another, and the ways that we harm ourselves. Disorder is the result of sin, and it continues to reflect our inability to be as good as we were designed to be. Among its many deleterious effects, sin has made us low-functioning creatures, and the paltry order that we manage to bring is a caricature of what God has intended for us. All of creation groans, Romans chapter 8, verses 19 to 22, in this state of delayed order and rampant disorder, the latter being the result of sin. That sin is most basically manifested in the idea that we thought we could do better than God, a delusion that still plagues all of us. Proposition 17. All people are subject to sin and death because of the disorder in the world, not because of genetics. We all agree that theologically, biblically, and experimentally, sin is particular to each of us, universal to all of us, corporately, and radical in its extent, not just behavioral. As such, sin is in need of a remedy. Less clear in Scripture is how we are infected by it. Neither science nor exegesis provides the answer, though they each can potentially identify problems with proposed answers. In the end, we will inevitably see a variety of possible explanations that are not ruled out by the Bible. We are then left to try to determine which is the best fit. Original sin. Why/how did all become subject to sin and death? This is not the place to delve into the intricacies of original sin, how sin spread to all humans, and how sin affected the cosmos, though some comments will be offered. These issues have been debated throughout the history of the Church, and a few caveats can help launch our brief discussion. 1. It is important to differentiate between what we experience negatively from a not fully ordered world that God still works to perfect, and what we experience from the disorder brought into the world by humanity. 2. It is important to recognize that there are categories of evil, and not